Good evening. This show is sponsored by Fleeta is alone in a hostile world, abandoned by her mother, betrayed by her stepmother, and her best friend, and sentenced to death. She is now trapped in the poisonous air outside the safe boundaries of the Protectorate. If the air doesn't kill her, the hideously deformed monsters that dwell outside will. Her only hope is to find the dreamer's way that will lead her to the Golden City and safety. But the monsters have already attacked and wrapped their deadly tendrils around her. Even if she knew the location of the Dreamer's Way, she has no way to get there. Or does she? Find out when you read The Dreamer's Way by Marie Atherton, available at www.swimmingkangaroo.com. Dive into a good book, The Dead Detective, a mystery novel by Lorraine Robbins. Free Foundation is now accepting applications for 2006-2007. All artists are welcome to apply. The foundation was established to assist the artist who has talent but lacks the resources to market his or her work. Possible materials the foundation can provide: editing, demo CDs, portfolios, headshots, connect with industry pros and leaders. Visit http://www.frezefoundation.org. This evening, the topic is health and medicine with Dr. Oleg Resnick. Good evening.
Good evening, Lillian.
How you doing?
Okay.
That's great.
And you?
Oh, pretty good. Pretty good. Staying out of trouble.
Okay.
So I understand we're talking about cancer this evening?
Well, I wanted to talk more generally about what one can expect from medicine, medical technology, pharmacology, and to take cancer treatments as one of the examples, but not for the sake of it by itself, but within the context of expectations and the general view of most people, what it is that they can expect.
All right. So when somebody, when a doctor examines you and finds cancer, whether it's in your stomach or in your lungs or in your breast or your head, what can a patient do to face it?
I'm sorry, say it again, the last part.
Okay, when someone's diagnosed with cancer, what are some of the common things that they are told by the doctor in order to handle it?
There's usually a long strain of all kinds of initially confirmatory tests, staging tests, and then the patient is guided into various kinds of treatments appropriate to their particular disease. But there's actually something that happens way before that, before any of us can be diagnosed or any of our family members, before we are diagnosed with cancer or before we're sick with anything for any matter, for that matter, something that I wanted to address is, even from the outset, there's a certain set of expectations about the capabilities of medicine which play a major role in what happens when we do get sick. It's kind of subtle, and I think most of us don't notice it until it happens. And it happens mainly, the build-up of expectations happens through mass advertising, direct-to-consumer advertising, certain TV programs. Many of the things that we see in mass media which show how great the achievements of medicine is, what great things we can do. And this is not to say that there aren't achievements. There are clearly very important achievements. However, in my opinion, and that's what I was planning to share with you and the audience, is that it is usually extremely exaggerated, way beyond the truth of the matter. And then when the person with the expectations actually encounters a problem, they are in for frustration and disappointment and increased suffering. And I think that by opening up this subject and by helping a person to see more realistically what they can really expect from medicine, today's contemporary modern medicine, they are in a much better place if they do need to use the help of medical system today. They will be more prepared and have a better perspective from which to look at whatever it is that they are recommended by the doctors who are treating them.
How did it happen that people now believe more of what they see? For example, the advent of penicillin, the advent of other miracle drugs, as they called them, and were introduced to the public as they were developed and approved. How did it become that people's expectations were blown out of proportion with these drugs?
Yeah, this is a very good question to really explore. It has, I think, more than one component. And I think initially the things that were discovered, penicillin is one good example. It was kind of a major breakthrough in medicine as a first major antibacterial drug. Medicines of different kinds existed for centuries and millennia, for that matter. But penicillin probably is one that marks the technological achievement, as we were able to have a microscope to look at the fungi and what they grew, and it was discovered how the fungi could resist the bacteria that they were producing this thing called penicillin, and then were able to isolate it and synthesize it. So it's a good example of how it started. And penicillin, as and you can say now, there are 15 other derivatives of penicillin that are much more powerful, certainly has its value. And today's medicine certainly has an important value for acute conditions, such as pneumonia, for instance. But even for the acute conditions, it is not all-powerful. Even if we take pneumonia, it does help to treat pneumonia, but for instance, usually it is, most people think that whenever you take a drug, you're going to have the effect that's desired. In other words, you're getting the benefit of the drug. Now, this was actually studied, and one way of studying how much benefit you can get from a drug, like a penicillin, for example, is there's something in medical research known as number needed to treat. And what they do is the researchers look at the number of people who have to take penicillin for it to make a difference in one person. Many people have trouble with this, so I'll be happy to really clarify this. But, for instance, if each person taking the drug is benefiting from it, let's say from a pneumonia, their pneumonia is cured faster, then number needed to treat is one. Now, if two people take a drug and only one of the two would benefit, then that number is two. Now, most people that I have encountered, the non-professional medical people, tend to think that number needed to treat is one or close to one for many drugs, even penicillin or similar drugs. Now, in fact, for pneumonia now, the outpatient uncomplicated pneumonia, the kind that many people experience when they walk around and get sick and then not quite sick to be admitted to the hospital, but still very sick to sick enough to see the doctor and get antibiotics and get a chest x-ray finding of pneumonia, number needed to treat is six. In other words, you have to treat six people for one person to get a benefit. In other words, this benefit is small. It's there, but it's a modest benefit. So that's how it started. So even with this very first example, I think it's worthwhile to show that it's that there is a definite benefit, but it's a small benefit. It's less than the majority of people envision. And I think what happened from there was our belief in technology and in what would happen if we develop this direction. Just I think we, to some degree, got ahead of ourselves and started believing things that that were really beyond our capabilities. So the penicillin was developing, and the new drugs were developing, and we were seeing the effects. But even at that stage, there was one. And before I proceed, actually, I wanted to ask you, was the way I explained number needed to treat, was that understandable? Did you
yes,
understand?
You were talking in terms of statistics and the amount of people taking the medication and who they worked with succeeded was how they based on how successful the drug worked.
Yeah.
I understood that.
Great. Okay.
Is this the same problem that they're going to be running into for the bird flu? Is the fact that the expectations of the serum that they're trying to create and develop will be the end all to cure anybody who contracts the bird flu?
Yeah, that's a whole new topic, and actually it was one of the topics I considered for following talks that we may have because it,
okay,
it is a big,
sorry.
It is a big topic, but yeah, they will definitely run into this problem.
Okay, these expectations then that the people have because of the type of statistics that the doctors kept for the drug curing people, and they what? They just got used to the fact that medicine would always have the drug to cure them?
Well, what I think happened, and at least in part, as I was trying to, where I was going with this penicillin and number needed to treat, one is it does help. It does have a modest help with treatment of bacterial disease. The extent of this helpfulness is small. Now, the other thing that is very often overlooked is the fact that for any disease, be it acute, but particularly for chronic disease, there has been essentially almost no progress with the management of chronic disease in modern medicine. Those diseases that have been successfully treated, what seems to happen, at least in my opinion, is we substitute one problem with another. Just to give you an example, some examples. For instance, there used to be a big problem, used to be until about probably 30, 40 years ago, stomach ulcers. Stomach ulcers were treated with surgery, a rather major kind of surgery. It was a chronic disease. People suffered and suffered the surgical consequences. Then a group of medications came out called H2 blockers, like the ones you find in the store, Zantac, Tagamet, and there are similar ones that are given for prescription. And they essentially were able to treat the acid, to suppress it, so that people didn't have to go for surgery. So that's cited as one of the achievements of medicine, and true enough, it is an achievement. People with this particular disease don't have to go and get the stomach taken out. The other example is AIDS. If you go to early 1990s, the treatments were very few, with enormous side effects and not very effective. Now we have a more effective treatment. It still has side effects, but it's a lot better than it used to be. So these are examples, and there are a few others, where you can say there has been a significant contribution of modern medicine and modern pharmacology. But if you look even at these very examples that I just cited, and you try to look in a broader sense of human disease and human suffering, that has not been reduced. The amount of chronic disease has not gone down. In fact, it's increasing. And the amount of other illnesses and things that are not treatable or not effectively treatable is just going up. And one example, which is a curse and a blessing at the same time, is cancer, because in cancer you can observe this lack of progress, whereas in other illnesses, if you look at only a narrow spectrum of having disease and then not having it, it appears like there's been an enormous progress. However, what happens is one disease is substituted by another. Like in the 1800s, syphilis was a horrible disease, was not treatable. Really, there were treatments that caused enormous side effects, great deal of suffering, and it was very complex, similar to AIDS in the early 90s. And then we came up with antibiotics, and you get a shot and you cured syphilis, but the human suffering has not diminished. The disease that was cured was substituted by another disease. Now, with cancer, it has persisted. So this disease permits us to see really our limitation better than others, because there has not been, as I was planning to speak about, there has not been really progress in the treatment.
So what are the expectations then of most people when they're told they do have cancer and the kind of drug programs that they are put on?
The expectations are, they vary, of course, from person to person. Generally, expectations are much, much higher than the reality. And when the person, the first time that the person usually encounters this is when they have their first talk with an oncologist. Who starts telling them that, talking to them in terms of statistical figures. And they're told that, really in terms of percentages, how much there is survival, how much there is likelihood of death, things that most people don't really understand, definitely not initially. But that's where it starts to come in, the expectation. Now, many, I think, never leave this expectation behind and never realize until it's too late that the expectation is false and may lead one in a false direction. What I mean by that is that the belief in the success of technology is so strong that the person will accept to undergo all kinds of medical treatments, radiation, surgery, that cause enormous amount of suffering, take away enormous amount of time out of their lives, because now they're spending this time, instead of being with their family, they are at the hospital, running from one doctor visit to another, from one treatment to another, from one hospitalization to another for treatment of their side effects, and then suddenly they are gone, and they don't, and they spent the short amount of time they had doing all those things, suffering, running around from doctor visit to the next one, instead of being doing something they would enjoy, being with their family.
Yes, but isn't that what you're taught to do? For example, I have a chronic illness, and I know that for at least 8 or 9 years of my life, I did exactly what you just described because I had a lot of faith, or as you put, too much of an expectation in what medical science can do for me. I know better now, and mm-hmm. I don't pursue it with the passion and the cooperation with the medical establishment that I did then, because I know that medicine is not an end-all. I know that if I die and they don't know what I die from, they're going to put down medicine is not an exact science. Medicine is not an exact art. In other words, they have no idea why I just died. They couldn't figure it out, but they're going to cover their ass so they don't get sued. But basically, they just don't know, and that's pretty much what you're saying.
Yes, they don't know, and if you look at the language carefully enough, you see that they actually admit it on the one hand, at least in the written form. There are always words like not well understood, unknown. You will always have that, but at the same time, the patient gets this... usually gets the feeling that the doctor is the one who knows everything, and the doctor is really in control. And many patients, I would say most, believe that, and they follow along this pathway that you described, you used to follow in the past. And then if it does happen that they succumb to illness and they are near death or they die, and the medicine didn't work, then this same doctor who appeared like a great authority will say, well, we tried, it didn't work. Essentially, you're doomed. You have very little time. Take hospice and make arrangements. And that's when the person sometimes realizes that maybe they went on a wrong path, believing and doing these things to end up where they have ended up.
So how can someone break that? I mean, we're taught to believe that doctors are close to gods, close to sainthood.
Yes. That's unfortunately true. And how are we supposed to break that? Well, one way is, I think, through information. So I have some information that I was planning to share that hopefully would shed some light at least on the effectiveness of most common cancer treatments. I think this would help to put medicine into a more proper perspective, where a physician's place is, I think, to serve the patient and to be a consultant. So the patient can consult a physician to get their opinion, but would not surrender themselves to the physician. Like when you hire a painter to paint your house, if they are professional and they tell you, well, this kind of color mixture won't look good or it's difficult to make, you may take their opinion into consideration, but you're not going to surrender yourself to them. I think it's the same type of attitude that one has to develop toward the physician and medical profession, that they are consultants, they may provide some information, but they are certainly not miracle makers. Their extent of help that they can provide for chronic disease is very modest, very, very modest, because it always comes at an enormous price of either side effects, other side effects causing other problems, being unable to tolerate it, or being completely ineffective or minimally effective. Almost any chronic condition you take, it's like that. You either get enormous side effects or it's not very effective. And it's not a secret, because the usual medical establishment will tell you that, well, we're treating it, we're not curing it. So it's called treatment, but at the same time, it is always exaggerated. And what comes to mind to me, I want to say this because I just, it always was like a lightning in my mind when I see this commercial. I don't know if you have this in Ann Arbor. We get here in Oregon, we get this commercial lately about heart attacks. And it says, it's something like that. There is a woman who is like a physician lady, and she is apparently well, but they say there's a background voice says, but she doesn't know what's going to happen. Something that's as small as a tip of her pen is going to clog her coronary artery, and she's going to have this terrible event going. Do you have this commercial?
It's a commercial for Plavix.
Exactly, great. I'm glad. So that's what it is, you know. So it puts immediately an idea in your mind that you are out of control, that you are in danger of a terrible thing happening to you, and you have absolutely no control over it, and the only help you can get is from Plavix. So go and persuade your doctor to give you Plavix, otherwise you're in terrible danger. And that's the other part of on the one part was the faith in technology, and the other part comes in this commercial is the fact that it became the disease became a vested interest and a big money maker, and so now we are selling drugs. And we're selling disease, unfortunately.
Well, not only that, it reminds me that they're selling insurance for people who have problems that they may not be aware of. And if their physician is doing an adequate job in ordering blood tests or doing a physical once or twice a year, they should be at least aware of what's wrong with their patients. I know. I have a funny story. I have very bad cholesterol. It's inherited. There's nothing, I mean, I'm on a restricted diet and all that stuff, but it was still very, very high. And I saw a commercial for Lipitor, and I walked in the next time to my doctor. I said, would Lipitor be of any use to me? And my doctor looked at me, and he put me through some tests, and he says, yeah, I think Lipitor would be just fine, and goodness knows it has worked a little miracle, not anything big, but at least it helps me a little bit. I guess it's my little sugar pill. But, I mean, I was aware of what's going on in my system because I made myself aware of what was going on, and I have discussed it with my doctor. And when I go in and more is a meeting of the minds and suggestions, maybe I should have this test, but if I don't want it, that's fine with him. Maybe I should talk to this doctor, but if I don't feel like it's life-threatening. But I know that a lot of other people, if their doctor said something like that, they just turn around and they make the appointment. Or they go in and they have this test. Or they go in and say, I saw these series of drugs being advertised on the television, and I really think I should be on them. And they're put on them. And I find that amazing that the drug companies can advertise their wares, which is what they are products, and have people go in and start telling the doctors they want to take them.
Yes, and when they advertise, I don't know if this is done intentionally or they are spontaneously doing this, but they use the techniques that are used in hypnosis. For example, most of the commercials, and the same thing that prompted you to seek your doctor for Lipitor, there are defined components of what makes people behave a certain way, how you can make someone behave, certain steps. You have to first show them something that is either going to be provide them a reward or a feared outcome. So in the fear works better, and so most of the time there is a feared outcome. For example, well, cholesterol. You may have high cholesterol, and the implication, even though it's not always explicitly said, is that once you have high cholesterol, that leads you to death. It's going to be danger, heart attack, death, that kind of pathway. So you should be afraid. We now have a product, like you said yourself, insurance. we have a product that prevents you. It will lower your cholesterol. So by implication, it's going to provide you insurance against disease and against death. Now, they don't say that it's not true, but that's the expectation that's immediately made. And then people very quickly go and ask their doctors, why don't you check me and put me on Lipitor because I don't want to have a heart attack and die. Now, if you were to ask the doctor, how much benefit am I going to really get from Lipitor? True enough, it lowers blood pressure, but if you ask another question, what are the chances of it making me live longer or a better quality of life? The answer to that is going to be a lot more modest. Now,
It doesn't change a thing.
It doesn't change a thing?
Not for me. It hasn't enabled me to go back on the kind of diet I had before I found that I had high cholesterol. I still have to watch what I eat. I still have to watch my carbs, my fat, my sugars. I still have to eat less. I still have to exercise, but I know I need to do this anyway. So a lot of the drugs that my doctor has me on, I'm sure, is keeping me alive maybe a little bit longer, but I know the only thing that's really going to keep me alive is my attitude.
Yeah, so it's good that you know that, because the effect of cholesterol lowering on life prolongation, I can tell, I'm looking as we speak, trying to look up that information, is much more modest than most people think. Let's see. 60 patients have to take cholesterol-lowering medicine for 5 years in order to prevent one cardiovascular event. That's the number. So,
That's a long time to wait.
Yeah, 60 patients have to take a cholesterol-lowering medication for 5 years in order to prevent one cardiovascular event. Now, that's heart attack or angina attack, cardiovascular event. Now, that's not even death. If you were to ask a question to prevent death, that number is going to be even less impressive.
Yes.
But if you were just to ask about heart attack, that's the number. Now, in 5 years, taking 60 people taking this medicine for 5 years, now some of them are going to develop side effects. Most of them probably will be like you, will not have side effects, will do great, but some will. So now when you see the whole picture, you may wonder, is it really worthwhile for me to do that for that many years to prevent one heart attack, to be one of 60 people? So that way it may still be worthwhile to take it for you, but if you were to one of those few people who develop a side effect, you might wonder, or one of those who don't want to take the medication every day and take monitoring blood tests, they may say, well, maybe this is not worth it for me. That's what the information offers. But I wanted to get back to the cancer treatments.
Certainly.
So we started talking about medications and
yes.
Went to penicillin. Now, one of the prominent people who was a believer in medical technology, and the person who really probably she wanted good for the world and for people, was Mary Lasky. Trying to look up her name to be sure, who persuaded President Nixon in 1971 to sign National Cancer Act, which committed the U.S. government to spend a certain amount of money on development of cancer treatments. So it was the first time that a particular disease was to be funded directly by the government and have an official appointed by the president who would oversee it. And so there's the data on that. So just that fact that she would make a step of investing enormous amount of energy, political connections, and money to make that happen shows how much she believed that this can happen, that with our efforts, our money, we could come up with a cancer cure. Now, if we look at the actual mortality data, There is a very little difference that happened 40 years later and billions of dollars later. And the difference is from 1970s to 1980s, a five-year survival rate for all cancers increased slightly from 49% to 53%. So five-year survival, meaning percentage of people surviving after 5 years, that's for all cancer combined together. So you cannot, if anyone listening has a certain type of cancer, you cannot really apply it to yourself. This is a combined data. But from 49 increased to, it's 49.3 to 53.9, a very, very small increase. And the data since 1980s to 2000 shows, again, very small increases in survival. The cancer of lung, there is a small decrease in mortality, 1.7% additional, and so on. Very small decreases, and an additional comment that the decreases cannot be all attributed to improved treatments, because there are other things that improve survival. And there are several of them worth mentioning. One is prevention, which decreases cancer mortality. When you, let's say, people stop smoking, which has been going on recently in the recent years, and the death from lung cancer is going down, not all due to treatment, but because there are fewer people who smoke. There are other things that influence specifically survival statistics. They are screening. So for prostate cancer is one cancer. It's a good example, because there is even agreement now in the mainstream medicine that screening for prostate cancer is not worthwhile. I should correct myself. There's not a total agreement. There are organizations that, like United States Preventive Services Task Force, Canadian Preventive Services Task Force, there's another organization, I don't remember now, who no longer recommends screening for prostate cancer because it was found that it makes no difference, that the treatment is ineffective, it doesn't prolong life. People who were screened and treated compared to people who were not screened, comparing those people, they live the same amount of time. Only those who were screened get treated, get surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, they still live as long as those who weren't. However, the screening produces the effect that's called screening effect that gives an impression of increased survival.
A euphoria, this, huh?
Yeah, I want to make sure that this that I can explain this well in a way that it's easily understood. Let's say you have a man who is 70. He has a prostate cancer. He doesn't know about it. It doesn't bother him. At the age of 79, he becomes aware that there is some kind of problem. He starts feeling something. And at the age of 80, he dies for whatever reason. Doesn't matter what he dies from. His survival is 1 year because at 79, the cancer was discovered. He dies at 80. Survival 1 year. Now, you take the same man and you do screening tests, PSA screening tests, and at 70, you'll be able to pick up that he has cancer. Now, you can treat him for 10 years. He still dies at 80, at the same age, but survival now is 10 years. Do you see what I'm explaining?
Yes.
I'm trying to explain?
Yes.
So, yeah. So
it doesn't really make any difference whether you
right.
discover it and screen it and treat it as compared to not realizing you have it and then discovering you have it, but you still die. He still dies.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter whether he has a cancer or not. His death will not be prevented one way or another.
Yeah. So it's not prevented. However, the statistical figures about survival start looking impressive. Look, we started screening people, and now our survival has increased by a lot. So there are many of these statistical way of approaching a problem that appear as if the effectiveness of treatment is a lot bigger than what it is, And prostate cancer is one good example because most of the even major guiding organizations now no longer recommends this. The official statement is prostate cancer, PSA prostate cancer screening, we no longer, there is no recommendation for or against prostate cancer screening. It should be discussed individually with the patient. Unlike mammography, for example, there is a clear recommendation to go ahead and do screen. The prostate screening was withdrawn several years ago for that reason, because the research does not find that there is a survival benefit, even though there is what appears like a relative survival benefit. There is a survival increased survival without prolongation of life.
What do they still then advertise? I've seen it a couple of times on the telly, that the awareness of prostate cancer, and they make a big deal about it. If these are the medical findings, it certainly, did these come out in the American Medical Journal? Is this common knowledge, or is just your doctor know it?
Did it come out in the American Medical Journal?
Yes.
Yeah, it came out in major journals, major American journals. This is among doctors. I think it is a rather common knowledge. I'm pretty sure it didn't. It's not just one article or something like that. This has been debated for a long time until those major organizations withdrew recommendation for routine prostate cancer screening. So people know about it. The physicians definitely know about it. And there is a split between the kinds of organizations that recommend it and the kinds that do not. Now, as we're talking, I'm trying to find the exact information, but I can tell you the United States Preventive Services Task Force and Canadian Task Force does not recommend it. Now, there are two who do still recommend it. That's the Academy of Urology and American Cancer Society. What are the differences between the two? Well, the obvious difference to me is that both the urologists and the oncologists have a vested interest in screening, because they are the ones who get paid for treating these patients. The preventive services task forces have no interest. They are there to evaluate what works for what doesn't work for prevention. Either way, they don't financially benefit, whether they would be screening or they would not be screening. The primary physicians who follow the task force, preventative services task force, would not be getting any kind of financial benefit, whereas urologists and the oncologists are really dependent on screening, because if you start screening, what happens is you grasp these enormous numbers of people, of men, and you bring them to their offices to be treated for cancers that they would have never known, would have never found out in many cases, because many men who have prostate cancer die of other causes without ever finding out about it unless they were screened.
Now, is this type of cancer, does it spread through the body like breast cancer would?
Oh, yeah. It can metastasize. It can be bad in any way that you can imagine, like any cancer. It can be a very difficult cancer. The problems are at least two problems I can mention right now. One is that there is a lack of effective treatment, which was studied and found out that you can treat the cancer, but comparing people who were treated with those people who were not treated, the treated people don't live longer. They are still dying. So the treatment does not make them live longer. So the screening does not work. That's one problem. The other problem, which is created by screening, is that people who have cancer that otherwise would not have been discovered, and that's a substantial proportion of men in this case, now this cancer is discovered and treated. There are many men, and as we speak, I'm trying to find the exact numbers, there are many men who And this was found by doing routine, by doing autopsies on men who died of non-cancer reasons, like from heart attacks, from motor vehicle accidents, other reasons. When they took men who were 70 or 80, and I'll try to find that now, they found that there is a significant percentage of them who have cancer, who have prostate cancer. But it's at the stage, it's at an early stage, and they died of something else. They died of stroke, of a heart attack, and so on. So if you did not screen, you never would have found out that cancer. You never would have treated it. The patient never would have known, never would have been bothered, and would have died of something else. Now, when the screening is advertised and is done, this is discovered and treated, and the person gets labeled, you have cancer. They are treated, and they still don't live longer.
That's a pretty raw deal.
It is. It is a raw deal, and that's why I think it's worthwhile to make it really more widely known.
Is there a way to educate people so that their expectations of these so-called miracle drugs or some of the things that have been told to them over the years, they can re-look at medicine and its drugs in a different light?
Well, I'm hoping that what we're doing as we're speaking right now is...
Opens the eyes, yes.
Yeah, we're re-educating.
Yes, I hope so, too, because too many people run to the doctor as an end-all for anything that on the slightest sore, ache, pain, distress, they just go running off without stopping to think, well, maybe it's something I can handle at home, something I can do first before diving into the pharmaceutical medicine cabinet at the drugstore and finding a remedy for it.
Yes, and in fact, you know, most diseases, certainly it is true for most acute conditions, they pass on their own. They really don't require any treatment. You wait it out and it goes away. But yeah, usually we run to the doctor's office and want to get something, and sometimes it's okay and sometimes it's helpful and other times it just adds to the problem. But it's okay. I think it would have been okay to check with the doctor. But there are certain inherent dangers, unfortunately, in that. And they are brought about by a number of factors. One is the commercialization of medicine. And so now there are vested financial interests. And what happens is what we talked about with direct-to-consumer advertising, where the patients will be essentially convinced by mass media to do certain things and to have certain beliefs, and then it's very difficult to change. And then they are they feel dependent, and they suffer.
And they suffer whatever effects that the medicine that they're taking can do to them. I certainly experienced that firsthand.
This type of commercialized medicine, unfortunately, it cannot regulate itself. There is a big difference if you come to me and you pay me whatever it is, and I treat you with something that I think may be helpful to you, comparing that with coming to me when I'm actually a salesman of a medication. And not only am I a salesman of a medication, but I am a salesman in a very hostile and highly competitive business world that is cutthroat, and I cannot afford, as a salesman, I cannot afford to be nice, to offer leeways. I have to just go all the way with the business, and I have to sell in every way possible. I will not be stopped by anything. And that's essentially the attitude of business now in order to survive. they take all the efforts that they can. They make there is no self measurement. They cannot measure their own what they're doing and cannot stop themselves. They cannot afford to stop themselves because then another company will outcompete them.
Do you feel that the salesman that comes around to the individual medical doctors to give them their samples are also guilty of this?
This is a subject that a drug company have researched, and they have discovered that this process of drug representative, which is the person who comes to speak to the doctor, that it does work in changing doctors' behavior. So they are investing billions of dollars in that, and they hire an army of the drug representatives who on a regular basis come in to see doctors and to mention the medicines that they are selling. They make it present to them and present in their mind by whatever means possible, giving them pens that have the names, sticky notes, anything you can imagine with the name of the drug, talking about the drug, giving pamphlets of the drug, to make the doctor remember the drug. And they know that when they do that, it works, the sales of the drug increase.
I know these hospitals have been, the drug people have been very successful with Tylenol. All the major hospitals that I have gotten to stay in, that's what they use for pain relief. And I have bad news for them. It doesn't work.
Each one promotes their drug, and the drugs have certain uses, but unfortunately, in their zeal to outcompete their competitors, they create an unrealistic picture of what it is. Suddenly, if it's a Tylenol, it's a wonder drug. They mention all the positives, which are true, that it has fewer side effects than others, but certainly it's not true that it's effective. It has a very mild effect. But they won't say, they're not going to say, look, we have a drug that has certain pluses and certain minuses. They can't afford to mention the minuses. Only those that they're forced to mention by the legislature, where they have to mention all the side effects, they tell them on the background after you've been already distracted by the fear that you're going to die and the suggestion that they have a product that that's going to prevent you from dying.
Is it true that most of that stuff, Bayer and Tylenol and the ibuprofens and all the other stuff, are pretty much the same? Maybe they have one or two different elements in them, but basically they're the same?
No, it's different. The Tylenol is very different from the other class of drugs, which is called NSAIDs or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which include ibuprofen or Motrin is the same thing, and naproxen or Aleve, Lodine. There's a whole bunch of them. So the NSAIDs are different from Tylenol. They have different set of side effects, they are essentially a little bit more effective and have a lot more side effects when used over long term.
Well, it doesn't matter. None of them work on me. I was told by one doctor I was too strong.
Too strong?
Yes.
Yeah. So if the doctor has has the courage to say that, well, we tried, it's what we can offer you is modest, and it doesn't work, so that's where the limitation of the conventional medicine is. I suggest you, it doesn't mean that you should give up, but explore other venues. You don't have to put all your eggs in the basket of this, of what I can offer you, unfortunately.
But you see, Western medicine does not offer you many alternatives. The expectations that they have built up within society is that Western civilization, i.e. the United States, only knows what's good for you, and anything else is fraud or sugar pills or hocus pocus, and therefore would not work.
Yes. And this is true, and this is, at least in part, I think, due to, again, competitiveness. It's a multi-billion dollar business, and you can't afford to take a chance of being out-competed, even on some small part of this business, to be out-competed by, say, naturopaths or homeopaths or Chinese medicine herbalists and so on. They can't afford that, and so there is a constant thrust, one is by pharmaceuticals, to influence, to create influence in the making of guidelines, then to create influence to the individual doctors by presenting through drug representatives the drugs that need to be sold that are the most profitable, and finally, but most importantly, by direct-to-consumer advertising, where this is suggested in the same way that the hypnotic suggestion works, by giving initially a feared message, something that that you can that one is afraid of, and then suggesting that there's something there that they have to offer you that's going to prevent you from disease and death, and then naturally you're going to run to your doctor and request that.
So your expectations then are pretty much tied up into a vicious cycle.
Yes, and unfortunately I see that a lot in my practice. A big part of my practice are Medicaid patients, the poor population, and these are the people who tend to be really tied into this cycle for many years. It has other complexities because there's also a social component to it. But yes, there's always an expectation something's going to be there for me. It doesn't work. Well, it's going to be something else, another doctor, another treatment, another surgery. People undergo surgeries and treatments and end up on multiple medications that they take for 20, 30, 50 years that cause multiple side effects to them and limit their ability to be a human being in multiple ways. So I hope that what we have talked about has opened up a door toward toward freeing someone from this enslaving belief into an all-powerful medical system that's going to deliver to them, provide to them insurance of health, provide to them security and permanence and prolong their life and cure their disease. It can do certain things. It's effective for many acute conditions, but the effect is very modest and has to be taken like that as something very modest.
And so we leave them with the idea that you only get out of the medication the expectations that you put into it.
Whether that's true is a whole topic.
Yes, I do this to people. I'm warning you.
Yes, yeah, and maybe so. And there are books where people argue that that's the case. There's no doubt in my mind that that's the case for the majority of the effect of the conventional medications. In other words, the medicines that I prescribe on a daily basis, my guess would be that regardless of what medicine it is, that at least 50%, if not more, of their effect is due to purely belief. In other words, what would be called a placebo effect. The person believes that that's going to help them, so they come in, they say, well, my son is sick, I need antibiotic. I give them antibiotic, not because I really believe they need it, but this mother who has such a strong belief that the antibiotic is going to cure her son, if I give it to her, it's going to cure it faster than if I'm going to have a half-hour session with her, which unfortunately I don't have the time for during the visit.
So you could almost say that medicine has turned into an opiate or a religion for many people.
It has. Yes, it has. It provides a false reassurance. and traps one into a vicious cycle. And I hope we have sparked something that maybe some people will start looking at it with more humor and with less expectation.
And also that your doctor is not a god. He's not even on the pedestal. He's just like you, or she's just like you. She puts on her shoes and socks 1 foot at a time. Otherwise, they fall down. Think about that. And that a lot of them who dispense all this judgment and medicine are having the same internal problems with their bodies that you are having, and that they themselves do not put themselves through the same rigorous type of testing or medication because they know better that it's not always going to work. Therefore, they don't subject themselves. Take it from somebody who's had 6 spinal taps, that after the guy suggested a 7th and 8th, I told him, let me see you do it to yourself, and I'll reconsider.
Yeah, that was good. Good awakening.
Because I refuse to take tests now. Oh, I really think you ought to go in and have the upper eye and lower GI. And I said, no, I don't think so. If I have cancer down there, sir, I can't have surgery anyway. I was told I was inoperable, so me and my cancer will just die together.
Very good.
You know, I said, enough is enough. I went through that torture for 10 years in Cleveland, Ohio, and guess what? No more. Or the best one I got was the prednisone that they put me on to treat me for my systemic lupus also gave me diabetes. Now I have trouble with my eyes. So after learning that, and I had to make a spot judgment, which was worse, diabetes or having the systemic lupus. And, you know, the prednisone really didn't cure me of the systemic lupus. I still have it. Still creeps up when I least look for it. So, friends, take it from me, unless you really need that medication or that test, you know what they say, just say no.
Perfect ending.
Thank you. Thank you very much for listening to Oleg Resnick on health and medicine and the expectation society has for our so-called miracle drugs delivered by doctors, the medical representative salespeople, and, of course, we cannot forget the drug companies and the insurance companies. I mean, just look what Merck has done with Vioxx, to name one. And please stay tuned for new shows tomorrow morning starting at 10:30 on the proper care and feeding of your soul. And health and medicine with Dr. Resnick will be back in 2 weeks where he will discuss another topic. Please be sure to tune in, and if you have questions, you can email me at lillian.caldwell@gmail.com. You can phone me, 734-332-5902. And the next time, please give us a call at 319-256-0500, access code 550703#. Tell us who you are and ask your question. I know Oleg would just love to answer any question you have about traditional and untraditional medicine and your expectations about it. If you want to hear this podcast or any other podcasts, other radio shows that you've heard today, please go to http://passionateinternetvoices.com. Dr. Resnick's picture is on the front cover of the web page. Just click on his name, and it will take you to his page where you can listen to this podcast as many times as you want to. And please also visit http://internetvoicesradio.com and visit my sponsors, Freeze, capital F-R-E-Z-E, foundation.org, that helps artists who don't have the funds go out and market and promote themselves, and Swimming Kangaroo Press, who publishes e-books and print-on-demand. They are now accepting fiction submissions. Please email Dindy Robinson at dindy@swimmingkangaroo.com. Also, WeK Organization, which is a world e-commerce network group for business ladies. Check out the site, http://www.wecai.org, and March Tarrant at http://www.funandcozyknits.com. Knitting just isn't for winter anymore. She's open Monday through Friday and half day on Saturdays to 1 o'clock. give her a call. Tell her Lillian sent you, 866-353-8159, or drop her a line at funandcozyknits@comcast.net. Thank you very much for listening, and we hope to see you tomorrow morning at 10:30 when Deborah Lentz-Hill discusses the proper care and feeding of your soul. Thank you, and good night.
Good night, Lillian.